Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, welcome back. Chase Thomas podcast, late on a Wednesday, where I am now joined, John Taylor, Fangraphs.com. John, good evening, sir. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you doing? That came out all weird. How are
that
you?
That was doing? I don't know what was happening there, John.
Yeah, that's just let's go ahead and say that's a we'll say it out loud. That's an audio error. If anyone heard that, that was not actually me speaking. That was something wrong with your podcast player of choice.
Do you know what happened there, John? I know what happened.
It's gonna be a really tortured segue, isn't it?
No tortured segue. Okay. What happened is you tried to flip the script. You did the hosting thing. You were like, how are you? Like, you weren't prepared for that.
That does make sense. I was going for the wrong cadence there.
Right. See, that's what was happening.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
See, like, that's how I am. Like, I can't do that. Like, I'm the person when I flip stuff accidentally. Like, I'm a host. I'm a terrible guest. I am not good at any of that because I get excited or I get super nervous and anxious and I talk fast and then I just, everything's out of whack. My entire order.
It all goes nuts.
Yeah, it all goes nuts. Like, I won't do it. Like, hey, you can hit me up, folks, on a podcast. Like, Chase, come talk baseball. No, not doing it because it's not going to be good. That is not my...
It's going to sound really weird, everybody.
Yeah, like, I don't want it. It's not me. But John Taylor, someone you definitely yes. want to have on all your Major League Baseball podcasts.
Well, thank you.
John, did you read... So there's a lot of Hall of Fame stuff going on. There's a lot of people upset. Like, there's the Curt Schilling voters that get people riled up.
There's a lot of people upset is the ideal way to describe the Hall of Fame debate every single year.
It never tires.
No, there are always people upset. Always.
I don't understand it. Like, it doesn't affect my life at all. It's like the I'm not even mad, I think it's funny type thing. But like, I read through it, I have my perspectives. Like, I think Bonds and Clemens should both be in. Pete Rose, I don't. Curt Schilling, I don't. If you don't agree, like, whatever, like, it's fine. It doesn't really faze me all that much. However, seeing this writer for the Denver Post, Mr. Saunders, did you see who he voted for that he announced to the Twitter world?
I didn't, because for the most part, I try not to pay attention to who votes for whom in the Hall of Fame balloting. I just care about the end result, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Because trying to reverse engineer the logic that leads someone to fill in... because there are a lot of... I remember from years previous, and the writers who did them are still doing the same thing. You know, you see ballots where you're just like, this just doesn't make sense. Like, trying to understand the internal logic of this guy but not that guy but also this guy but not that other guy, it just gives me too big of a headache and makes me too mad. So that's a long way of saying no, I just try not to look at ballots if I don't have to.
Yeah, and I mean, they shouldn't. I like to believe that everybody's doing their best, that they're operating in good faith, they're voting in good faith, and that's just their perspective. And what are you supposed to do? You vote based on what you think is right and how you think it should go. That's fine. However, I don't understand the logic of placing Gary Sheffield into the Hall of Fame and leaving out Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. That those do not compute. Those are things that when I saw this, I was like, I just, what? Like, there are certain conclusions that I don't know how people come to said conclusions. Like, John, without reading the piece, is there a way for you, Mr. Baseball, you have the button down. You have the I'm the Rob Lowe of Major League Baseball button down. I've seen it. You did the baseball tour. You are the baseball guy. Is there a way in your Major League Baseball brain, John Taylor, that you could wrap your head around writing in Gary Sheffield, but then simultaneously leaving off Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens?
Yes, if you're a really hard, if you're no on PED guys, then yeah, that makes sense to me.
But
because
Sheffield?
At this point,
are we sure?
Because at this point, yeah, because at this point, it's really clear, barring some totally new evidence that we've never heard of or seen before, or unless someone comes out as they have not so far in you know the literal decade now since Sheffield has been retired, there is one instance of him. At least accepting and using steroids. It was summer of 2002 when he trained with Barry Bonds, and he was given what he says he did not know were steroids. He was not told that they were steroids, and that when he learned about it, he stopped using them immediately. He admitted that in 2004 to a grand jury, so he's under oath. He would have been committing perjury to lie to them about that in testifying in the Balco case. I believe that. I don't really see why Gary Sheffield would perjure himself for one small instance, and there has been no other, like I said, there's been no other example. He never failed the test. He was never on the Mitchell report. He was never named as any one of those guys. It was just that instance with Balco with the cream and the clear. That's where that all comes from for him. Unless something else is out there that we don't know about and we haven't heard, I don't really see what PED evidence you can really hold against Sheffield unless you are still hung up on that particular incident. And everything he said about it and everything that's come out about it suggests it was a genuine, honest mistake on his part, that it was an accident. And given that, you know, I can see voters given that, you know, maybe, and I think too, it helps for him. It clearly has helped him that the ballot has thinned out in the last 2 years, and I think voters who saw him as more of an on-the-fence guy when they're filling in their ballots now are thinking, you know, I got room now. You know, I'm not using all 10 of my votes. Why not give a vote to Gary Sheffield? By the offensive numbers, at least, he's very clearly a Hall of Famer, et cetera, et cetera. So I can see making that vote if you are a hardline no PED guy, because it's very easy, and I think it's the truth that Gary Sheffield really was not part of that. I think with Bonds and Clemens, it's a lot more tortured to get to that point. Like, I don't have a ballot. I have no idea what I would do with mine if I were given it. Bonds and Clemens are genuinely, like, I think I would vote for them ultimately. I would probably vote for Sheffield as well. I don't know. I don't remember exactly who's on the ballot, so I don't know, you know, who would get all 10 of mine, but I think I would vote for all three of them. But I can see how someone wouldn't if the steroid stuff really is that big a deal to them. And I can understand it. Bonds and Clemens, you really do have to kind of, it takes a lot more of a active justification, I feel like, to check those boxes. Whereas for Sheffield, it's a lot easier to say. He was linked one time. It seems like it was a genuine accident and a mistake. The rest of his career looks like it was completely clean. I'll vote for him, you know, unless you also want to hold it against him. He was kind of surly and unpleasant sometimes, which, I mean, and that's the thing about the Hall of Fame. The people making these votes are humans, and they have inherent biases, subconscious or maybe pure or entirely conscious. And they're not the ideal way to decide this, I suppose, because they bring, like I said, they bring their own biases to these tables. That's how you end up with these leaps of logic, in a sense, where you can say yes on Sheffield, but no on Bonds and Clemens, because you consider steroids to be a kind of deep sin that can't be washed away. So, I mean, this is just always going to be the end result of the BBWA doing the Hall of Fame vote. I don't think that there's a better solution necessarily. I mean, ultimately, we're still just talking about a museum, but I mean, that's just the end result. Is you are just going to get ballots like this, and you're just going to have to sit there and try to make peace with that logic as best you can. Though I think, you know, like I said, voting Sheffield, not voting Bonds and Clemens, I can see the logic behind it.
Okay, fair enough.
I think it's. I think there are ones that are way harder. Like the people who vote one of Bonds, like one of Bonds but not the other, or one of Bonds Clemens but not the other.
Mm.
How do you thread that particular needle? I know John Heyman does it.
Does he?
With his ballot. He votes yes on Bonds and no on Clemens.
Weird.
I don't understand that particular splitting of hairs. Although granted, I think Roger Clemens is a human garbage can, and I would honestly, if I had a vote this year, given that it is last year, I think I wouldn't vote for him just out of pure spite. But see, there you go. There's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, the tiny biases and personal grudges and whatnot that each of us have toward various ball players. Sometimes it overshadows the simple cold logic of like the numbers and how good a guy was and all that other fun stuff. It's like all the stuff with umpiring and you know versus human umpires versus the robo strike zone. It's about the human element, I suppose.
For sure. John.
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember where you were sitting when the A's hired Mark Kotze?
No, because when did they hire Mark Kotze?
They did that this week.
Okay. Was it like yesterday or the day before?
It was in the last 48 hours, I think, right?
Okay, well, I was probably sitting somewhere at home. I mean, that's a good bet.
Am I breaking Mark Kotze news to you right now?
I guess. I mean...
Am I breaking this to you?
Mark Kotze? Where
yeah, it was 2 days
where
ago.
Was Mark Kotze, okay, where was Mark Kotze before?
I think he was, like, on the bench. I could be wrong. He was, like, an...
Was he the Padres bench coach?
Maybe. He was a Padre at some point. I remember he was a Padre. Do you remember he was a first-round pick?
Yeah.
Ninth overall, man. That's kind of wild. I never just, like, had Mark Kotze first-round pick in my head. I'm trying to pull up where he was before.
I'm glad that the era of guys becoming managers continues apace, because Mark Kotze is really a guy. He's really a guy.
He is really a guy. He is... I get this just makes sense. It's a 3-year contract, club option through 2025. Billy Beane obviously likes him a lot, right? Like Billy Beane mm-hmm. is a big fan. So this is what Beane said about the hire. Quote, funny the way things work out, Beane said. We thought we were going to get a chance to draft Mark in 1996. Ultimately, that obsession with Mark as a player continued. We traded for Mark in 2003. And he had an outstanding playing career here with the A's and went on beyond that. So we can go ahead and pencil in Eric Chavez as the next Oakland A's manager in 2030.
Eric Chavez is on the Yankees coaching staff now.
He is. Like Miguel Tejada maybe in the mix in 2032.
Let's remember the 2003 Oakland A's.
Coco Crisp in 2040?
I guess Kotze was on the 2004 Oakland A's, so... slightly different, but regardless.
Mm.
So he was already with the A's. He was their bench coach, and then he was their quality control guy. So it's a similar path then to what a guy like Rocco Baldelli or a guy like Rocco Baldelli took to becoming manager, or someone like it's escaping me now. Or Sam Fold, except to becoming a general manager. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense for the A's is hiring a guy who's right there, who already knows the system. And, you know, I think it makes sense for them as an organization, given where they are, which is to say they don't want to spend money and they're probably not going to be in Oakland very much longer, that they want a guy that is young, that can just kind of grow into the role and that they don't have to pay very much and kind of just see where it goes, especially because no matter what, I think the A's going forward next year are going to be a more youth-oriented team. I'm trying to find the nice way to say they're going to, you know, do some form of teardown. And I think you're going to be getting a lot more of those kind of younger players that a guy like Kotze would make more sense for as a, you know, guy who's closer to them in age and who has played semi-recently. I mean, he only just retired in 2013. You know, he's only been out of the game for about 10 years, and of course he's still been involved in the game. So this makes total sense for Oakland. It's, unfortunately for Kotze, I don't think he's going to be overseeing a winning team anytime soon. But, hey, it's the A's, so who knows? I mean, we always say the A's aren't going to win, and then they go and they just win 92 games like clockwork. So
yeah, I wouldn't cancel anything out just yet. But I will say the AOS did get more complicated for the A's bouncing back with the Texas Rangers waking up from a decade-long slumber. So we'll see what that actually manifests on the field, but we won't get to see that for a while. So we'll have to see. It's going to be an interesting thing because I think there's a strong case. Like, I'm very curious to see what Pakoda and Zips and everybody else pegs the A's at next year, because I'm very fascinated to see what the AOS looks like after all the signings and everything else is done, because the AOS is going to be really, really hard to forecast. But I'm curious to see what all unfolds there. And it is just kind of wild, right? Like, Bob Melvin just left. Melvin was there for so long, and he just was the A's manager, and he was just cool, calm, collective. He was the coolest manager in baseball. Like, I remember reading that piece. I forgot who wrote it for The Athletic, but it was really great insight into his style and why guys like him and the open door policy and him just always being honest with dudes. And I don't know. I think San Diego got a great one. And then them turning Jace Trimble into Bob Melvin is like the most under talked about. Like, everyone's all like, oh, what's happening with Aaron Boone, or Buck Showalter is the next Mets manager, or who's going to be this, or who's going to be... It's like, the Padres quietly nailed their managerial hire, I think. I'm really excited to see what Melvin does in San Diego, and that's just the perfect bounce back guy to have when you had the season from hell that they just had with injuries and everything else, and to get the bad juju out. That's who you bring in, is Bob Melvin. But Kotze, I think, is just in a, hey, just collect those checks and try not to be god-awful next year.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough time in Oakland, I think. That franchise just seems like it's reached a kind of terminal point, or at least some kind of hinge point in its history, and I think the next few years are not going to be particularly fun there.
I tend to agree. Speaking of Showalter, though, it's happened. John Buck Showalter back in baseball. We're not sure if he was coerced into it based on that Zoom introduction call where he looked like he was being held hostage in that media session, whatever we want to call that. But Showalter is the next manager for the New York Mets. Do you like the move?
So I know when we talked about this last time, I made a point that, you know, it's not exactly clear what the identity of the Mets is that they hire Showalter, because he's a guy who's not he's not a part of the current game. He hasn't been a manager since the disastrous wild card game against the Blue Jays with the Orioles years back when he left Zach Britton in the bullpen. But I do think that for as much as, and then certainly based on the other names that were being bandied about for interviews, which was a lot of those kind of younger, kind of Alex Cora style bench guys, I think it makes sense, you know, I'm thinking about it a little more, that this current iteration of the Mets, which is to say the Max Scherzer, you know, Starling Marte win now Mets, or at least win soon Mets, I guess. Maybe they don't win now, but they're certainly, you know, that's certainly the aim. I think that there's probably a feeling that, you know, the manager needs to be someone who understands that environment, and Showalter definitely checks those boxes. He is, you know, he managed in New York before, he has managed playoff teams, he knows what that atmosphere is like. He is not someone who is going to have trouble, I think, dealing with it. And I think the other part of it is, presumably, and again, given the nature of this team, as you know, if you kind of want to think about it as Max Scherzer's team and think about the fact that Scherzer is 1-38 and 2 only here for the next 3 years, it kind of makes sense to think that the next couple years, the next 2 to 3 years of the Mets will be a gung-ho attempt. Let's see if we can win that World Series. And if it doesn't work by then, by the time Scherzer moves on or retires, I suppose, or whatever happens, then maybe you start looking at, okay, now maybe we change gears and we do something a little more quote-unquote sustainable, or whatever baseball looks like at that point, given that we're going to have a whole new CBA by the time we get there. And maybe that's when you hire a guy who's more like an Alex Cora or more like a Mark Kotze. It's really weird to talk about these guys who I remember watching them play and now they're all managers.
I mean, there's just juniors everywhere. Who was the latest one I just saw who's like kid is getting ready to... Who is it? Because it was Tatis, man. That was like the bonkers one years ago now. But I'm trying to remember who was the most recent one that I saw. Do you remember?
I had a moment where I was looking through the Marlins roster and I noticed a guy with the last name of Encarnacion.
Oh, no.
And I was like, if that is either Juan or Edwin's kid, I'm going to freak out. It's neither. He's not related.
Okay.
But yeah, it's. I think it makes sense that the Mets would rather take a gamble on one of those guys being the guy later on when the pressure isn't right now to win. I mean, we saw what happened with Luis Rojas, which you know, you can argue, no, he was not the Mets' first choice. Then Carlos Beltran was. Rojas was very much the fallback choice. Rojas really didn't seem ready for that kind of role. And for as much as guys like Cora and Aaron Boone and Gabe Kapler have managed to succeed, one, it has not always been a straight path for any of them, really. Cora is really the only one who found, you know, he won right away. And I guess Boone did too, but certainly the years after have not proven to be so kind to him. And then there's always the option, the possibility, you get stuck with a Brad Ausmus, that you make that decision, you invest the money into a guy who just isn't ready for the job and just isn't capable of doing it either the first or the second time around. So I think it makes, in that sense, it makes perfect sense for the Mets where they are right now to go with Buck, to go with a proven quantity who they, you know, they know if nothing else, he's not good. They know what they're getting with him. And you can argue whether or not what they're getting with him is going to be enough, given that, again, this is a guy who is not, you know, we shall see how versed Buck is in the new way of playing baseball, which isn't to say that the new way is the only way or the correct way, just that it is not something that, again, that Buck Showalter really has experience managing in. But regardless, I think it makes sense for where the Mets are now. And I certainly don't think it's a bad hire. I think there certainly were, you know, obviously, they're like Billy Epler, I think there were way worse choices the Mets could have made. I do like this more than hiring Epler, but mostly because I think it just makes more sense with where the Mets are right now as a franchise to go ahead and give Buck that job. Because honestly, if it hadn't been Buck, you know, I remember going to the offseason thinking if the Astros actually do let Dusty walk, he shouldn't go to the Mets because that's cruel to Dusty, but he would make a lot of sense for them. Or a Bob Melvin type. That's kind of the guy I figured would end up being the Mets manager anyway. It's just, to me, it's a little surprising that they went back and kind of dipped into the retro bin and ended up getting Buck.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. At the very least, the Mets are going to be so fascinating next year. Who would have thought the Mets would be really weird and interesting for another season? Did you see the Guardians are in the process of changing out ownership? The Dolans will not be the majority owners in the next couple of years, so they phase them out with the group, or a member of the Joshua Harris group who bought the Sixers and the Devils. So he, I think, is a minority owner with them, or a co-operating owner or whatever. The verbiage is just not important here. It's more that Dolan is out in Cleveland and new ownership's coming in. I don't know if that will mean any kind of change with the way the Guardians will operate going into the remainder of the 2020s, but it is, I guess, at least a little bit interesting that the Guardians have a possibility of changing some things up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's my vote, and this is based on absolutely nothing, because I don't know what Josh Harris is like as the owner, of the Devils or the Sixers.
The Devils has not been good, but the Sixers, I guess, he at least takes chances.
I think it's with the Sixers, it's how much is he exactly responsible for? Because the vibe I've always gotten from the Sixers is what goes on there that matters is what happens with the players on the court, with whoever the head coach happens to be, and with especially with the front office and all the absolute weird wackiness that's happened there in the last 10 or so years, I guess, from the Sam Hinkie reign onward. I've never really gotten the sense, again, not a Sixers fan, not a Philadelphian, have no idea, but like, so I don't know what he's like as an owner, but he doesn't, like, I don't get the sense of Philadelphia as one of those teams that won't go for it financially. Maybe I'm wrong. If, you know, if there are any Sixers fans listening, please don't mail rotten eggs to my house or whatever. The Devils, I don't watch hockey at all. So I hear you say they're bad. I'm sure, whatever. I don't think the Devils have ever been good in my life, except for a brief period in the 90s when Marty Brodeur was there.
I thought you were going to say when the boyfriend with Elaine from Seinfeld.
You mean,
was a super
Putty?
Yeah.
Devils. Yeah, no, it was great. He also apparently is a general partner in Crystal Palace, one of the lower-tier London Premier League teams, which, sure, whatever, who cares. I can't imagine this changes too much for Cleveland. I mean, whoever takes over is... They're not Steve Cohen, I think, is the thing. Like,
Yeah,
Joshua Harris is a billionaire, but he's also a private equity investor. Like,
I think that's what this guy is too.
Yeah, and like, he's not going to spend money big. Like, none of these guys are. They'll spend money. The reason they want to buy a team is not to do anything with the team on the field.
And I think
it's to do everything about the team itself, which is to say the money that can be made from TV deals, the money that can be made from streaming deals, the money that can now be made from local partnerships with gambling and casinos and sports books. I can't remember if gambling is legal in Ohio, but if it's not, I'm sure it's at some point on the way.
Yeah.
The partnerships that can be made just with business in the area. And the most important one now that I think we're seeing a lot of teams are really making that push. And we've already seen already from the Cubs are going to do it. We've seen the way the Rangers have done it with their new stadium. The Braves did it with their new stadium. I can't imagine that Cleveland probably has an interest too in developing the area around whatever the park is called. Now it's always Jim Jacobs in my mind, and I'm just going to keep calling
it. I'm not calling it forever. The Jake.
Yeah, exactly. That area, I assume there is a big desire to turn that, from the team's part, to turn that area into one of those like big restaurant and bar and stores, like mini entertainment areas where you can just funnel a ton of money into real estate, which is, you know, a huge cash cow for a lot of these businesses. And I guess that's the thing. Like, I am assuming that Joshua Harris, unless he is secretly a Cleveland Guardians fan from way back in the day, you know, he wore the Chief Wahoo and was a big Doug Drabek guy. Was Doug Drabek ever on the Indians? I don't even remember. It doesn't matter. Point is,
Jim Tomei, Albert Bell.
This is like I'm going to say, this is not a Steve Cohen situation, because this is not a fan buying the team. This is not someone who wants to win baseball games. I don't think Joshua Harris gives two craps how many games Cleveland wins, so long as Cleveland makes money. So long as the Guardians are a money-making enterprise, that is the most important thing here. And I think that they probably saw, I mean, I can't say exactly how Cleveland's business operations work, because I just don't know. I would imagine that there is probably a feeling that they represent an opportunity where by spending just a tiny bit more, they could probably reap some somewhat larger investments, because the vibe I get off Cleveland is a team that does not try very hard in that capacity. So, you know, I mean, again, it's a Dolan owning it. There's only so much good they could do. So I imagine they probably saw an opportunity there. And I can imagine a guy like Paul Dolan, he has enough money at this point. What does he care? Like, he clearly doesn't care about winning anything anymore either. And I wonder if he's just accepted that a Cleveland baseball team isn't going to win anything at any point. You know, because it would take an investment that he does just not want to make anymore. So I will give him kudos for this. Kudos for finally releasing your iron grip on this team. Unfortunately for Cleveland fans, I don't really see that this is going to be a more cash-heavy era. I think Cleveland will probably, I don't think it's necessarily a bad sign, but I don't think it's the same as the Mets with Steve Cohen. I don't think there's any real reason to expect that new ownership is suddenly going to open the wallet and start throwing cash around. I think they probably will spend a little more, but that's partially because I can't imagine a version of the Guardians where you somehow spend less. That is hard to think about. Like, they're already like bottom 10 in the league in payroll. I don't really see how. Well, although who knows? Maybe these guys come in and they McKinsey the whole thing and just decide that the best route forward is spending even less somehow. So we'll see. But ultimately, I don't think it means more spending for Cleveland, if anything, or significantly more spending rather.
Speaking of spending, though, before we get into our Tampa Bay Rays season preview, and that when you think Tampa Bay Rays, you think spending. Carlos Correa tossed around with the Chicago Cubs, and the Chicago Cubs were like, this was not on my radar, and I still will not put this on my radar, but man, would that not be weird if the Cubs do decide to go in on Carlos Correa? Like, is there a like, when you think of the idea behind them giving Correa a mega deal and the possibility of it, could you see it? Does it make sense to you? If you're Correa, does that make sense? What do you think of that?
The way I approach Correa in terms of does it make sense is the same way I approached, does it make sense with Bryce Harper and Manny Machado a couple off seasons ago, which is to say that you can make an argument that any team should do it. Like, with the exception of however many teams currently have a general, like the team we're about to talk about, would it make sense for the Tampa Bay Rays? No, not necessarily. They already have Wander Franco. But on the other hand, would it make sense for the Tampa Bay Rays? Sure. You just put Wander Franco over at second for like a few years or something. Or who cares? It's Carlos Correa. And I think that ultimately is the thing. Who cares if it makes sense or if it doesn't necessarily? It's Carlos Correa. And I think it does make sense for Chicago because, I mean, I don't know their farm system well enough to know if they have some, as if with Yankees fans, they'd be like, oh, we don't need Carlos Correa or whatever. We have Oswaldo Peraza and Anthony Volpe. I don't know if it's the same situation with the Cubs, but I know that there's no option there right now, you know, that they don't have a plan there currently. So why not? Why not Carlos Correa? And again, this is a guy who's young enough and talented enough and certainly valuable enough. that even if you do have to outlay 10 years and $350 million at minimum, or 12 years, 400 or whatever it happens to be, he'll probably be worth it. You know, if nothing else, he'll give you a ton of that value up front. And I think as you know, I think I've mentioned a couple of times when we brought Chicago up before, you know, this is a team that I certainly don't think you're going to pencil in to say, oh, they're going to be a contender next year. But I think the gap between them and contention is not as big as it would seem. And I think certainly it would get a lot smaller if they were to do something proactive on top of signing Marcus Stroman, like adding Carlos Correa. So, you know, I think there is, I think it would make sense, but I also do think that the Cubs are more likely to decide that Stroman was their splurge and that they're going to aim for being kind of a, like I said, a low 80s win team that maybe sneaks into the, maybe can capture the NL Central if no one else is really trying. Although, granted, I think Milwaukee and St. Louis are just too good for that strategy to work, but we'll see. Or maybe they can sneak in via the expanded playoffs if we get that through the CBA. And if we don't get that through the CBA, then maybe they revisit and say, okay, fine, screw it, let's shoot them in with Correa. But I think it would make sense for them, certainly. I just have a hard time seeing them do that after, one, they already spent money on Marcus Stroman, and two, given how allergic they've been to spending money otherwise. That to me would be the surprising part there, because it's going to take a huge amount of money to sign Carlos Correa.
Yeah, but weirder things have happened, and the Tigers just being penciled in as the favorite there. It's like, I don't know, and then the Rangers came out of nowhere and just spent all the money. Yeah, so I don't know.
I don't think we can write any team out except for the ones that never show any interest in spending, like, because that is just literally...
Like, we can wipe the Rays out from signing Carlos Correa.
Like Tampa and Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, where you can comfortably say, no, they're not going to do that. But yeah, I think
Pirates
Chicago
probably too, right? Pirates are probably.
Yeah, Chicago is definitely a team though with the means and with the opportunity. It's just a matter of whether or not they have the desire.
I hope it's the Rockies.
That would be very stupid for so many reasons, but it would also just be depressing. I don't want Carlos Correa sentenced to the Rockies for the rest
of
his career.
He would hit so many home runs in Colorado.
He would be so sad.
Yeah.
That's such a cruel way for his career to go, is just to be exiled to Colorado.
Yeah, but hey, I don't know. I doubt it, but I want Colorado to do some weird stuff.
They do weird stuff all the time.
No, they don't do weird stuff. No, hold on. That's not weird. They're just bad. They just do dumb stuff. They do dumb, boring stuff. They just let their good price players walk, and they trade for nothing, and they do all kinds of dumb things. They don't do interesting things. I don't think they're...
Okay, that's fair.
They're just dumb and boring and sad. Which naturally brings us to the Tampa Bay Rays. They won the AL East this past year. John, we wrap up our AL East season preview with the Rays. They lock up their guy, their future, Mr. Franco, long term. They signed the 2022 AL Cy Young winner in Corey Kluber before the lockout got started here. John, when you look at their season, what ultimately happened? No World Series appearance, but another great year in Tampa Bay. We'll see what the future holds with them in the city and the Montreal stuff. But by and large, John, when you look at the Tampa Bay Rays in 2021, what did you think of this group?
So I guess at the same time, like I guess ultimately disappointing, because anytime you win 100 games and you lose in the division series, it can't help feel like a disappointment, especially given that, you know, that I'm sure it stung for the Rays to lose to a Red Sox team that they were just overall better than, and that they proved that over the course of the season. The problem, I think, with the Rays is certainly by the time they got there, their depth had worn so thin, particularly pitching wise. Obviously, Tyler Glasnow was gone as he blew out his elbow. They had traded away Rich Hill. Obviously, the offseason prior, or during the offseason, they traded away Blake Snell. They were really relying on, you know, innings from very young guys like Shane McClanahan and Shane Baz and Luis Patino, and it just didn't work. And I think it's an illustration of how Tampa's strategy, you know, it's always the idea that they do more with less. Sometimes there's just not enough to do more, if you know what I mean. Like, sometimes there isn't enough. And I think that was the case where and a lot of that has to do with injuries. They've had a really, really bad and unlucky run of arm injuries in particular to their pitching staff over the last two or three years. They've had a lot of Tommy Johns. They've had a lot of shoulder injuries. They've had a lot of guys just constantly up and down. So, you know, I will cut them – my hair gets weird to say – I will cut the Rays slack in that regard, that, you know, they've had some bad luck there. But they've also just – in their reliance, I think, on going more toward relievers and less kind of toward the traditional starter, they've kind of put themselves in that position where that depth isn't as deep or as good as you want it to be. You know, they had to give a lot of starts to Ryan Yarbrough and Drew Rasmussen and Michael Wacha, one of their rare bargain bin finds that really just didn't pan out. You know, they had to give those guys way too many innings because the guys they obviously wanted having, you know, to give those innings to were hurt or unavailable. And, you know, depth problems happen to everybody, but I think you make the problem worse for yourself when you are deliberately kind of avoiding an entire chunk of existing, not only an entire chunk of the existing starting pitching market, but also when you have these, you know, when you have this pitcher development where you have these guys throwing only a handful of innings at a time. I am sure some of that, especially when it comes to guys like Patino and Baz and McClanahan, who also I think all three of those guys have dealt with arm injuries in the past. You know, I am sure part of that for them is managing innings to avoid injury, and in particular managing innings after 2020, when those guys either pitched, you know, only a handful of innings or never pitched any professional innings at all and spent the entire time at an alternate site or whatever it happened to be. But I do think that is the real problem that the Rays have started to run into, is that as good as their pitching development is, this kind of amorphous bullpen rotation structure, I don't know how well it necessarily – I don't know how well it necessarily works in the postseason when it does just seem like you want at least one or two guys who can reliably get you 15 outs at minimum. The Rays didn't have nearly enough of that available to them in their rotation. They were way too reliant on guys like McClanahan and Baz, where 15 outs was going to be an absolute miracle in a lot of cases. You know, they asked for too much out of their bullpen. And I think you can make that work over the course of the season because, you know, their particular approach of they have a lot of up and down relievers. They have a lot of guys who they'll burn for three innings at a time, send down, bring up another guy. You know, that can work over the course of the regular season because a lot of the teams you face, you're just better than. You know, and that was the case with the Rays especially because they have a great offense and a great defense and a very good bullpen and a very good player development system. They're just better and they can get away with that. But I think that exposed how difficult that is to work in the postseason. And I think, you know, you saw how it can work at best in 2020 when they had that system, but they also had Blake Snell and Tyler Glasnow, who are guys that they felt, I think, more confident could give them 15 to maybe even 18 outs, I mean, World Series accepted, I guess. And that just wasn't there in the postseason. And some of that is just the unfortunate injury luck of losing a guy like Glasnow, and some of it is just the bad, I guess you can call it in hindsight, bad decision-making of trading Rich Hill and not having a guy like him available, although I can't imagine he would have made too much of a difference one way or the other. I think ultimately that's going to be the main issue the Rays are going to have to figure out is how do we, especially given the constraints that we place on ourselves in terms of the money we spend and the activity we do in free agency and having to sign guys like Corey Kluber, not simply because I think, you know, obviously they think there's something with Kluber that makes him valuable to them and that they think they can get ace level production out of him. But that he's in their corner of the market, which is to say a guy who would be available on a one-year deal or for less than $15 million a year or both, ideally, because he has a bad injury history or because he has, you know, not a long history of production. You know, guys like that, that's where they always have to shop. And I think there is everything has to line up right for that system to work. You have to be a very smart, very lucky team. And it almost happened for them in 2020, but I think in 2021 you saw the reality of that, which is, to call back to Billy Beanes, his shit didn't work in the playoffs. The Rays shit may not either unless they get something closer to reliable starting pitching, I think.
I think that's probably where it goes, but I also think that, like, it really just depends on how you view baseball, right? So, like, for me, I think it still technically works because they're still getting these bites at the apple. I just don't see them continuing getting the bites at the apple, right? Like, things get weird. The Braves had no business winning the World Series this year, and they went out and won the World Series. They won with the margins, like with Charlie Morton. Like, that's the, like, the Braves had Tampa Bay Rays like run.
The Braves won with a very Rays like team ultimately. They had a few regular mainstays, and then the rest of the roster was a lot of mix and match and a lot of platoon and a lot of bullpen. Like, mm-hmm. That is how a team wins nowadays. I think the Rays certainly pioneered that formula. I think them and Houston, I think, went a different direction, but kind of similar. I think the Rays definitely pioneered that formula. And I think you're right. The whole goal is to get a bite at the apple. Once you get into the postseason, anything can happen. You know, as you saw with Atlanta, as you see pretty much every year. Every year there's at least one team that goes, I think, a little further or does better than most people would have expected. And I think that's what Tampa's aiming to do. I just think by the time they got there last season, they didn't have what ends up being an essential piece to that strategy, which is a starter who can get you 15 to 18 outs reliably, which is what a guy like Charlie Morton would have been if they hadn't, you know, let him go, which I think qualifies as probably their biggest blunder of the year, was letting Morton walk for really no reason whatsoever other than choosing to save money, which again, and that's what I'm talking about. The Rays handicap themselves because they won't spend the money necessary essentially to guarantee that their own strategy works. Which is not to say that Charlie Morton was a guarantee. Maybe there was something the Rays saw with him in 2020 that ultimately they decided this is not going to work out over the course of a full season. I don't know. I have a hard time believing that they magically saw the end of Charlie Morton coming and also were proven to be very wrong. But regardless, yeah, the goal is get to the playoffs. Anything can happen. I just think the Rays are lacking an essential tool to making it happen. And
Do you think it's eventually... Well, I mean, is it eventually Glasnow? Is it eventually McClanahan?
I think that's the thing. I think they're hoping eventually it's not just one of Glasnow or McClanahan or Bass. It's all three of them, ideally, and maybe Patino and maybe, you know, whoever else they find and develop or draft or trade for in the years to come. I think it's always that strategy of, can we find an ace on the cheap? That's what they did with Blake Snell. They got the best years of his career for the lowest amount of money. They dealt him when their time was up. And then they got a guy in Patino who they're going to do that all over again with, theoretically. You know, I just think that's – they are always essentially trying to hit on the black in the roulette wheel that is winning pitcher development and turning one of those guys into 180, 200-inning-a-year starting pitcher who can give you those game one starts in the postseason. Because that really is essential. You really, really do need that, it feels like. We'll see how things go now that everyone kind of got back to the rhythm of a full season. And I think pitchers are going to be allowed to go longer in postseason games next year because the context is going to be very different. But regardless, yeah, I think the Rays' ultimate goal is they want that. They want it to be Glasnow, although now with his Tommy John, that's, you know, we'll see if he even pitches next year. That's going to be a very big question for him going forward. But now maybe it's McClanahan. Maybe it is Baz. Maybe it is Patino. Maybe it's, you know, whoever it happens to be. So... It is a strategy that makes sense. It is just the problem with the Rays is, again, because of their own self-imposed financial limitations, that's really the only strategy they can pursue. They don't have the luxury of being able to afford, or they choose not to be able to afford backups. You know, they choose not to be able to spend extra to do something like keep Charlie Morton just in case, you know, because ultimately $15 million for a player should not be a make or break decision for any franchise. That's not a lot of money in the game of baseball, or however much it was that his option was. I think it was somewhere in that $13 to $15 million range. But yeah, no, I think that is the strategy they have tied themselves to. And I think you've seen how far it can get you, but I think you also saw last year that it only works. You only go so far as the players you develop in that scenario. And the unfortunate thing for the Rays is between injury and I think 2020 had a lot to do with it too, with a lot of interrupted development. They just didn't have the guy they needed in that series atop the rotation. Mm-hmm. I think they can. I definitely think they can going forward. And I think it probably will be one of, you know, you saw what McClanahan and Baz can do. They're outstanding young pitchers. It's just a matter of how long is that going to take? And knowing that the path from pitching prospect to, you know, good starting pitcher, it's not a short one, it's not an easy one, and it's not a guaranteed one. Pitchers break, you know, that's just what happens. It's a really risky way to make a living. I mean, the Rays get away with it, though, because the floor is so high everywhere else. You know, they have a really good modular lineup. They're so excellent defensively. You know, they fill holes on the roster on internally better than any team in baseball. I think even better than the Dodgers. They're just so good at all the little things that help make a team consistently good. They are just that kind of impact. They're like two or three, I think, impact pieces away from basically being literally the Dodgers of the American League.
Mm. Do you think they sign anybody else? Who do you think they sign to address some of this once baseball theoretically returns?
It's a good question because I think rotation-wise, Kluber is probably where they end up, you know, what they end up calling it with, because he just makes sense for them anyway. And because I think it makes sense for them, you know, they're going to have McClanahan and Baz next year. They'll have Kluber now. Presumably, they'll give Patino some chances. Presumably, Drew Rasmussen is a guy they want to keep working with. And then
Colin McHugh is definitely going to be a dude, right? Like, because he's coming back.
Or, you know, whatever it happens to be. Like, and I think they also will probably continue having that kind of rotating fifth starter spot where it's maybe it's a guy who gets called up from the minors and throws three or four innings and the bullpen fills in behind him. Maybe it's a full-on bullpen day, as has been the case for them a lot. You know, maybe it's as they tend to do a lot during the year, and they just pick up some random veterans every now and again or here and there just to kind of supplement and fill out the roster. But I think, oh, of course, Ryan Yarbrough is part of that too. So I think rotation-wise, they probably feel comfortable. I think lineup-wise, I'm not really sure. I'm sure they would love to dump Kevin Kiermaier at this point and just move on from him and ideally, you know, get out from what the enormous amount of his contract still left, which must be so crushing for them. And I mean, if I were them, I would probably try. I don't love the idea of third base being a Yandy Diaz plus production. I mean, maybe it's Taylor Walls helping out there. Maybe it's Vidal Brujan,
Chris, you know, Bryant.
That's the thing. I think a guy like Bryant, given the way their roster operates, would make way too much sense. Like, granted, I think that's the case for a lot of teams, but boy, does he fit that roster perfectly as someone who can play multiple positions across the defensive spectrum. I think bench wise they could probably use some help. There's not a lot of guaranteed or really even quality offense on that bench right now. It's mostly defensively oriented. But ultimately, I kind of can't see them really making much more in the way of moves. Maybe they look and see what's left on the reliever and starter market in terms of guys who might be able to come in for 1 year on the cheap. But in terms of a big addition, I can't see it. I have a hard time seeing it. I mean, this is a team that won 100 games last year, and really the biggest loss from that roster is Colin McHugh. Otherwise, you know, I know they had Nelson Cruz, but he really did not do much with Tampa. He kind of was just there. And otherwise, it was a bunch of pitchers that just didn't work out for them. So, you know, really this roster has, you know, is coming back pretty much entirely the same. So I think you can argue that, you know, they probably feel like, you know, what additions do we really need to make? There's a lot of internal reinforcements coming. We're going to get a full year of Wander Franco, which is enormous. Ideally, they'll get a full year of Randy Arozarena, because I know he missed some time as well. I imagine that the Rays probably feel very good about where they are with the roster, and most of what I think is coming is probably going to be along the lines of roster depth and not so much, I think, any kind of marquee signing, unless there is an opportunity that one of those guys, maybe a Bryant or a Store or a Trevor Story, although I don't really know where a Story would fit. Regardless, maybe they become available as like and are open to a 1 year pillow contract to try again next winter when there's obviously going to be way more CBA clarity, or maybe they just prefer whatever it is. You know, maybe they jump on the market for one of those guys. Otherwise, no. It looks like the Rays to me feel pretty done, and that roster, if you look at it, it's a really, really good roster. This team is very, very annoyingly good.
What does your ultimate gut tell you, though? Do you think they repeat as AL East champions next year? Because that's like the under-talked about thing with the Rays. Like, for me, that is the biggest thing that just blows my mind, and something that I don't think enough people consider when talking about the Rays is that, like, we make this joke about the Orioles, and it could easily just be horrendous for the Rays with their limitations, everything else. Instead, what they're doing, in my estimation, even if we, like, fundamentally disagree with, like, how they're doing it, what their rationale is, that sort of thing. The fact that they won the AL East by 8 games this year, and the fact that they are able to do this in the AL East, which is just, we've talked about this ad nauseum in this podcast. The Blue Jays maybe were the second best team in the AL this year, and they didn't make the playoffs. Like, there's a case to be made that the Blue Jays would have just run roughshod. Like, they're like, that offense is legit, and like, they've spent, they're going for it. The Blue Jays are well run. They're a powerhouse. The Red Sox, they're back to being a powerhouse. The Yankees, obviously a powerhouse every year. There is just something to them just being able to do this. Like, when we talk about how difficult the AL East is and how much of a bloodbath it is at all the times, and why it's so complicated for the Blue Jays and the Orioles to realistically compete every year, the Rays are just like, hey, we're just going to go ahead and do that. We're not only going to fly by the birds, we're also just going to outwit and outplay the Yankees and the Red Sox a preposterous amount. Like, I think that is something that they deserve a lot of credit for, because it's pretty bonkers when you consider just how good that division was last year.
Yeah, and it's a testament to the depth they have built throughout that organization, and it's very similar, if not identical, unsurprisingly, to the way the Dodgers operate, which is they are just the best regular season team in their league. They are the most consistent team. They have the highest floor. Like I said, they are so good at finding internal replacements, at coaching players up, at getting better performances out of players, either through some mechanical change, some adjustment, through a deployment. You know, maybe a guy that they think, oh, he's not a starter, but he would be a great platoon bat or something. That's just what they do. They are just such a smart team, and they exploit all the little advantages. They take advantage of all those. You know, it's that extra 2% mentality. And I think that's what makes it so easy for a lot of people. And I think this is probably where I'm at, just to say, until something changes otherwise with that organization, why would I bet against them? Like, yeah, Toronto is really good. New York, the Yankees are really good. The Red Sox, I'm not as sanguine on them as you are. But yeah, they're better now. They're legitimately good again. But those teams also feel like they are more capable, or more susceptible, rather, to flux. Like, there's a rock steadiness to the Rays that owes to that depth, and owes to their player development system, and owes to their major league coaching staff, that I think puts them ahead of every other team in the division, that just makes it so much easier to be confident that they're going to weather the storms that come their way, and that they're probably going to rip off a long winning streak too at some point, because they're just flat out better in so many different ways. They're just a well-run, well-organized, well-executing baseball team. And I think, until and unless that roster changes for the worse, and I think this is true for every team. You know, injuries could always tear a hole in all of this. But I mean, again, look how many pitching injuries the Rays suffered the last 2 years. How many guys they lost, not just lost, but also for an extended period of time. There are a number of guys, like I said, who've blown out their elbows in Tampa in the last few years. And yet, last season they win 100 games. Near before, they win the pennant. They almost won the World Series. They're immune to these kinds of things because they are just such a well-run organization. And I think, to me, they're the best-run organization in the American League, I think. They're right up there with the Dodgers in terms of being the best-run overall. And with that in mind, like, I just don't really see any reason to bet against them, you know? To me, they are the AL East favorite until proven otherwise. And I think...
And it's the bite of the apple thing. People were making jokes about the Dodgers until they didn't. Like, oh, they keep winning all these games, but then
that's the point. Like, yeah. you win the division so that you are in the best possible position in the playoffs. That's the whole point. Like, the Dodgers winning all those divisions was a sign of just how, you know, hard it is to win that many divisions in a row, even with the garbage at the bottom of the NL West. Like, that's no joke. And like, the Rays obviously haven't pulled that off quite as, you know, they haven't pulled quite that off, but still, like. Yeah, like you should be proud of winning a division, especially the AL East. It's really hard, and if you win the division, guess what? That means you go to the playoffs, and you go to the playoffs as one of the higher, or I don't know, we'll see about if there's a seeding system going forward, but as one of the higher odd playoff or World Series contenders. That's a terrible way of saying it, but yeah, no, the bites of the apple matter. It's just, can the Rays optimize, or whatever, their roster enough to be in a position where they can take the best and biggest possible bite, I think. Last year, I think that by the time they got there, they basically had, like, their jaws were wired shut to just torture this metaphor all the way out.
There you go. That's how we'll end it. I like that. That's a happy Christmassy way of ending things, John.
Yeah.
John, are you done with your Christmas shopping as we wrap up here?
I am done with my Christmas shopping. Okay. I like to get that stuff done early.
There you go. Did you go in stores? Or did you order everything online?
Yeah. A lot of stuff online. Some stuff I got in stores, but mostly was online. If you can avoid the crowds, avoid the crowds.
How does that work though in a New York apartment? Like, do they go up to the top in front of your door?
I ran out of hiding spots real fast.
I was gonna say, I don't know how this works. Okay.
I ran out of places to store stuff really, really soon. So yeah.
I like it.
Creative.
There you
go. A lot of creative work there.
John Taylor, we can find you on fangraphs.com. Go subscribe to Fangraphs. This holiday season, give a gift. Fangraphs to somebody else. Do that.
Yes, you can gift, for those who do not know, you can gift a Fangraphs subscription. They make for a great little digital stocking stuffer, you know, whatever you, however you'd like to look at it. It is $20 for the full year, or $25 for the full year. I've already forgotten our prices. Point being, you can sign up for a Fangraphs subscription, either a regular subscription or one that lets you browse the site ad-free. You can gift it to a friend, a family member, baseball obsessive nerd in your life. Do it. Go do it now. Fangraphs, we're cool. That's our thing. We're cool.
It's also good. Great content, great pods, great stuff. It's easy to read.
Great stuff.
Clean website, responsive clean website. It's one of my favorites.
All kinds of stats for the stat nerd in your life who just loves stats and numbers. We've got all the numbers.
For the accountants out there.
Yes.
We've got the baseball.
For those who like the Ben Affleck movie, The Accountant.
Never saw it.
I've seen it. It's one of those movies where it is an all-time watching over someone's shoulder on an airplane.
I feel like that's a lot of his movies.
It's a great movie to watch from 7 feet away with no sound when you can't understand at all what's happening in it.
I like it. I like
that. Am I the only person who does this who, when they're on the plane, watches other people's movies sometimes?
Honestly, I've never done that. Like, because I don't fly that often, so I'm probably not the right person for this.
I would do this all the time. I just find myself kind of looking over and be like, oh, I wonder what they're watching, and then watch like 2 minutes of them. I'm like, all right, cool, and then keep going with whatever I'm doing.
I'm an out the window person. Like, I can't be on the aisle seat. I gotta be at the window. Like, I'm usually just staring out the window. Like, I'm a window guy. I like the views, as they say. I like to zone out. John Taylor, you have yourself a Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, sir. And I'll talk to you one more time before 2022. Exciting stuff, John. I will talk to you very soon.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.